You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, August 26th, 2020.
I think that some students are still not voting because they still feel like their vote doesn't matter, that it's not going to count.
Later in the program, the League of Women Voters begins a podcast on the WFHB local news. In today's segment, the League talks to Josephine McCormick of the Big Ten Voting Challenge on how to engage young people in the voting process. That's coming up in today's feature report.
There's actually some research that shows that mental illness causes homelessness as often as homelessness causes mental illness.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Diane Walker of the Limestone Post continues her ongoing series titled Eviction Crisis in Indiana. But first, your local headlines.
Up first, here are three headlines you need to know today. WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti files today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Wednesday, August 26th. I'm Aaron Comforti. 940 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Tuesday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health, which also added another 31 reported cases to last week's tally. The State Health Department attributed 6 new deaths to COVID-19 yesterday as well. Locally, Monroe County saw 24 positive cases reported on Tuesday, while Lawrence and Greene counties reported 10 and 7 new cases, respectively. Indiana University has not yet published its COVID-19 dashboard that it promised to publish in a town hall meeting last month. It's unclear when or if that will happen. The Monroe County Community School Corporation voted to open an in-person, 5-day-a-week schooling option to all students beginning on September 8th. Special education and career development programs will open in-person and hybrid models about a week earlier. While some families have enthusiastically supported reopening in-person classes, families who prefer it can continue to learn 100% online. The reopening announcement came after school board members voted on Tuesday night to adopt a new metric system that determines whether the school board considers it safest for school to be held online, in person with an online option, or a more limited in-person hybrid model with an online option. Brandon Schur cast the only no vote for the motion to approve the timeline and plans for reopening. This school corporation's new metric system has come under criticism for its reliance on contact tracing, which some note cannot be carried out effectively given that people may not receive their COVID-19 test results up to a week after they take the test. Tomorrow, the Indiana Historical Society is hosting a free event on Zoom called Rethinking Redlining and Segregation, a prologue to the COVID-19 crisis. You can sign up for the event on the Historical Society's website. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
The Monroe County Election Board discussed voting sites for the November 3rd general election during their August 25th meeting. Election staffer Sherry Morris said an accessibility survey was conducted at every 36 potential voting site.
We used one standard series of questions that was created by combining three sources of information. One is the typical CCA survey. When they do a CCA survey, they evaluate elevators, all entrances, because they're checking a whole facility. We were only checking those areas that were related to elections. So not all entrances, not any elevators, because we don't need elevators generally. So in addition to the CCA survey, we used a 2016 DOJ checklist for polling places, and also the 2018 ADA polling place checklist from the Indiana Secretary of State.
Moore said the points of interest in the survey were parking, entrances, exits, and path of travel, and restroom accessibility. She said 29 of the sites have parking barriers. Moore said most can be fixed with cones and signage. Moore said restroom barriers could be solved in three ways.
fixes are certainly one possibility, is to allow voters needing accessible facilities to simply vote quickly so they can exit quickly and take care of their personal needs. Because we may have lines, so, you know, we don't want to make anyone obviously uncomfortable. Another possible fix would be, and we've discussed this, adding portable, accessible restrooms outside the facilities, if the facilities allow that. Those are not the easiest things to use, as we have learned in discussing with individuals with accessibility needs from Stone Belt, but that's certainly a fixed option. And then, of course, finding an alternate site is always the third option.
Morris said details have been collected on each site. She said Bloomington Transportation would not be an ideal voting location.
The issue, potentially, is it is a tiny room, and therefore our ability to social distance workers and voting tables so that there's a comfortable area, personal space around each one, I think could be a real challenge. We are guessing maybe 3 voting tables could be in that facility, in that room.
Board member Hall Turner said he would not feel safe voting in such a small location. Morris said Free Methodist Church could be an alternate voting location. Morris said Edgewood High School would not be a voting site option. She said one alternate location could be the Ellettsville Christian Church.
It is a larger than the town hall. Parking, we can fix it. Entrance and exit is great. The restroom, it's not perfect. There's supposed to be 60-inch wide stalls. This is 54. We would have the option of course, discussing any of that. Voting first for voters, portable, whatever we want.
Morris said Meadowood would not be an option for voting this year either. She said the Unitarian Universalist Church would be the nearest site to move to. Board member Carolyn Vandeweel had concerns about COVID risks.
My one concern is that we're talking about a high student population poll and a high risk senior poll for Meadowood. Combining those two might be a little bit of a question mark or make some people nervous.
Turner said all residents of Meadowood would qualify for mail-in ballots. Morris said the Genesis Church voting site does not comply with ramp requirements. The election board voted to recess the meeting.
As the election approaches on November 3rd, the League of Women Voters starts a new podcast on the WFHB local news. On today's segment, host Jim Allison talks to Josephine McCormick of the Big Ten Voting Challenge. McCormick talks about engaging millennials and Generation Z in the voting process. Stay tuned for next month, where the League will discuss the impacts of gerrymandering in Indiana.
You're listening to Issues in Civics, a podcast collaboration between the League of Women Voters, Bloomington, Monroe County, and WFHB. And I'm Jim Allison, your host. Today, we're welcoming Josephine McCormick, who is Student Ambassador for Political and Civic Engagement with PACE, that's the acronym for that organization, and leader of the Big Ten Voting Challenge. Thanks for being here today, Josephine.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been thinking about those 2018 midterm elections when Generation Z, Millennials, and Generation Xers accounted for 62.2 million votes, which set records for turnout in the midterms. Now, these enormous turnout rates, according to Pew Research studies, increased the most for the Millennials, roughly doubling between 2014 and 2018. Among Generation Z's, 30% of those eligible to vote turned out for the 2018 midterms. And for the first time, more than 50% of Generation Xers turned out to vote. But these voting numbers are still lower than baby boomers. And my question for you, Josephine, is what are your thoughts on why young people are turning out in higher numbers, but a large majority are still not voting? What issues are motivating young people to vote or not to vote?
I think that there are several different factors that account for this. One is that I think organizations such as the Big Ten Voting Challenge and myriad others are doing tremendous efforts to reach out to students, to reach out to young people, and get them engaged and excited for elections. But I think that there's still a disconnect between voter engagement before an election and then actual turnout at the polls. And that is one area that I know we at the, with the Big Ten Voting Challenge at IU still struggle to provide a greater connection to, is that it's one thing to engage students on issues that they care about, and it's another thing to actually get them to turn out for that, for those issues and for those candidates. I think that some students are still not voting because they still feel like their vote doesn't matter, that it's not going to count. Especially when you see more and more young people get involved, you feel like, oh, other people are taking care of this, or there are other people advocating or fighting, so it's really not going to make much of a difference. That's something that we still push all the time, is that yes, you know, every single individual does have a play in this and is really important, even if you don't realize that you were constantly advocating just by demonstrating healthy voting habits. You are still, you know, helping to be a peer mentor to your friends, even if you don't realize that. So I think that it's really important for us to stress the connectivity that we have among young people today more than any other generation, and use that healthy peer pressure to really encourage people to vote. Be like, hey, get a group of friends together and go down to the polls together. Or, you know, this year it's like, you can all have a phone tree and make sure that you're calling your friends and making sure everyone is registered for a paper ballot, an absentee ballot, or whatever it is. I think that it helps a lot when you see more and more people get involved and stay involved. That makes other young people likely to join in on these processes. But yeah, so that's a few of the factors in which people are still not voting at quite the numbers we'd like to, but we're seeing tremendous increase, and I imagine, and I'm really hopeful that that will only continue.
Very well, thanks. It's complicated, but it's understandable, I guess. Okay, thank you.
Like with everything nowadays.
Of course. Say, Josephine, tell me about the Big Ten Voting Challenge. How does this encourage young people to get out and vote? And how has it increased voting within the Big Ten, if it has done that?
Yeah, I think that one of the most helpful aspects of the Big Ten Voting Challenge comes directly from its name. You know, it's a friendly competition. And for students who are choosing to go to Big Ten schools, a lot of them really lean into that more competitive mindset. And so framing the Big Ten Voting Challenge as a challenge, both for yourself, a personal challenge, and one for your community and one for your school, helps a lot of young students really feel like they have a stake in this. So that's one way in which we really try to encourage people in the Big Ten, at least, to get involved. Another is just that healthy peer pressure a little bit. When you see more people your age developing these lifelong habits, you start to do it too, and then it just stays with you for the rest of your life. So even when you're not living and learning within such a tight-knit community as you are when you're in university, you're starting to build those lifestyle choices right now that will stay with you and have an impact on you forever. So that's really important. And I think that we have definitely seen tremendous increases across all of the Big Ten universities that have been engaged in this challenge. And here at IU in particular, we've been really impressed with our numbers and know that that will only increase. I think a big part of that is just greater visibility of challenges and competitions like this, where people can recognize different initiatives and start to get engaged. And that's really special and really important. It makes us happy. And I also think it's just greater connectivity overall. You have young people who can be reached across a multitude of platforms and by a multitude of different agencies. So you have social media campaigns, you have Twitter threads, you have Facebook groups that are all working to promote youth voter engagement.
Well, Josie, that sounds so promising and motivates my next question, which is this idea of the Big Ten Voting Challenge something that could be replicated to promote and increase voting by young people elsewhere? If so, how could it be replicated?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the really cool things that we've talked about within the Big Ten Voting Challenge when we had a convening more than a year ago at this point is that that was already happening among some other universities. So, you know, you have schools that are getting together and starting to replicate this model, but then you also have different groups who are starting to trickle it down into the high school levels and begin that engagement as soon as it's able to, which is awesome. That's really what you should you should be focusing at. I think that one of the things that has made the Big Ten Voting Challenge so successful is that it is nonpartisan. And so there's not a focus on dividing by party lines. It's all just focused purely on getting engaged in electoral processes in whatever way makes sense to you as a young person. I think that young people, we really value our autonomy. We really want it and need it, especially right now when it feels like so many other things are not as easy to engage in and are not quite as free. You need to really stress, hey, you know, we don't care who you vote for or in what way. We just care that you are voting on the issues that you care about. And that as a young person, you're starting to navigate that on your own and you're starting to take notice of which politicians are standing up for you. That's really important. That's building critical thinking. That's, you know, building a sense of self-worth and purpose that it may not seem like voting does all of that, but it really does when you get down to it. And that's really important to foster in young people. So I think that, yeah, this is a model that can definitely be replicated and definitely should and will continue to be, but will look different in the coming years, that we'll always have to evolve with technology and with the way that we are voting and the ways that young people are staying engaged.
Okay, Josephine, just one more question for you. What advice might you have for students in our listening audience for this coming election?
My advice, not just for students, but for anyone too, who is really focusing in on the upcoming election, is just to stay flexible. I think that this is like so many other things this year. It's a year of different challenges, and that means different opportunities and different ways to reach out to people who maybe have not been engaged in the past. And so I think just stay flexible and stay open. I think another thing that's just really important is that you vote. No matter who you are and what you care about, it's important that you just find some way to turn out if you are able to make it a visible statement to encourage other people to turn out. Say, hey, I'm voting this year. Are you? You know, checking in on your friends, checking in on your family, making sure that they have all of the resources and tools that you are able to provide for them is really important. Because when it comes from someone that, you know, you know and trust and care about, you're going to stay way more engaged than if it comes from someone like me who's, you know, talking at you through a camera this year. So I think that those are some of the ways that we have to really approach this next year is stay flexible, stay voting, stay engaged.
Well, I think you're very persuasive. thanks for listening to us on Issues in Civics. This is Jim Allison of League of Women Voters, Bloomington, Monroe County. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots organization, citizen-led, that has fought since 1920 to improve our government and to engage all citizens that impact their lives. Next month, join us when we talk about the impact of gerrymandering. What is it and how does it affect voting?
Up next, Diane Walker continues her ongoing series titled Eviction Crisis in Indiana. Today, we speak with Forrest Gilmore and Shalom Community Center Deborah Myers of Southern Central Indiana Housing Opportunities and Jamie Sutton of Justice Unlocked.
I think it's also really valuable to know that the experience of homelessness is wearing. And so it gets harder over time. It becomes more and more difficult just because of the burden of it and the ongoing draining of our energy and resources. There's actually some research that shows that mental illness causes homelessness as often as homelessness causes mental illness. And I think that's important to know. And I think some people think homelessness is kind of an easy, you know, easy lifestyle where people just get free food and shelter and blah, blah, blah. And it's actually one of the most stressful experiences a person can experience. And to add on to, you know, what Deborah was saying about, you know, then to have that, for that to happen to a child and a family that's with dependent children, you know, that just all adds to the stress of it. Basic things like trying to get to work, trying to hold down a job. I'm talking to somebody right now who works third shift and they're doubled up right now, but they're about to lose that opportunity in about a week and they're trying to figure out what to do. But they work third shift and there aren't shelters available for people who work third shift because they're working when most people are sleeping. So, you know, and this person's now worried about having to choose between their job, shelter, sleeping in a car. You know, and so these are the real challenges that people face with this. You never want to let people get into a situation of homelessness if you can. Always want to prevent it if possible.
Deborah, you had mentioned whenever we talked before that one of the solutions, there are solutions short of homelessness, of course. There might be finding another apartment that's more affordable, or there might be moving in with family members. Could you talk about some of the challenges that are faced whenever someone just leaves their home voluntarily that maybe we might not think of?
There's all the things that are related to the geography of the location. So, you know, where one lives at one point in time, may have certain access to jobs, if you have dependent children in schools, if you have to move, again, even if you can avoid homelessness in terms of being on the streets, but if you're doubled up or you just need to find another place to live, all of a sudden your transportation needs, you know, may change. Are you farther away from your job? Did your kids have to change schools because you're no longer in the same neighborhood? So there's all sorts of things that housing instability, again, in terms of the continuum of housing needs, if one is having to move frequently, again, that instability just creates all sorts of uncertainties that can have that cascading effect of, again, access to jobs and family supports, other, you know, social networks. Right. You might have had a tight neighborhood. Uh-huh. I think you told me about, you know, your neighbor when we were talking and the supports that she was finding there. And if she had to move, you know, that can just disrupt a whole lot of stability on a number of levels.
Right. And one of the things that she has that's helpful is that she has a neighbor who occasionally watches her child and does it for free. And that's a huge financial benefit.
Child care is another huge consideration, whether how much it costs, how easy it is to get there, to bring your child there if your child's not in school. So many considerations, even if it's moving as opposed to immediate homelessness, that are a consideration.
Forrest, your agency is helping with some of the rental assistance that we talked before. And I believe that you're working with what is called Emergency Solutions Grants, which is money that is designed to help people at risk of homelessness. And I think it's up to 50% of average median income. Do I have that right?
Yeah, our particular role in this is most people applying for this funding won't know which programs are necessarily assigned to, but we specifically will be working with people who have 50% of the area median income or below with homeless prevention, rental assistance, yeah, to really support them and prevent eviction.
How much money does Shalom have to administer in this way?
There were two organizations funded in our community. Shalom Community Center received $500,000, and New Hope for Families received $150,000. There's the potential option for us to seek more funding in the future if we see this funding, you know, run out. So nobody really knows, I think, as was alluded to earlier, what's going to happen or how this is going to affect people or who's going to need it. So we don't know the full depth of the demand and the need. But that's the funding sources that we have right now to address it, at least in the near future.
And there are actually two types of rental assistance available. The assistance that you're administering and helping with is for up to 6 months of rent. Is that correct?
I believe so. I believe that's correct. Yes. I know we can do quite a bit more up to full rent. You know, it's income adjusted and such, and pay back rent and things like that. So it's more significant than the rental assistance program in terms of the ability to help, because we're working with the people who have greater income challenges.
You also mentioned the rental assistance program, which is $500 a month for up to 4 months for $2,000. And that's for people who are affected by COVID-19, but who are not in as bad of a financial shape as some of the people that you help. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. You know, those are for folks above 50% AMI. I'm not 100% sure what the exact cap is for that, but that's all determined through the Indiana Housing Now .org website. When people make an application through there, then that the folks at IHCDA for the state of Indiana assign people to the appropriate programs.
This is a good time to mention the website again, which is, as you said, indianahousingnow.org. And it is IHCDA, which is Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, that has this money to help people with. And I believe that the last time I talked to them, they said that it was taking about 2 weeks. And the way that it works is that the money goes directly to the landlord. Is that correct?
Yes. And that's how most rental assistance programs work. So someone might apply to IndianaHousingNow.org and then might get assigned to, say, Shalom to do that work. We would start then working with them to make sure that all the paperwork that was needed was taken care of and get that all taken care of, make sure that the landlord was in agreement with the program. And then we would start paying the landlord directly for the amount that was needed for the program.
Are you finding that landlords are eager or at least willing to participate in this kind of program?
I mean, it's an interesting amount of paperwork and there's a lot of things that landlords have to read through and sign in order to embrace this. So there's definitely that communication challenge, that kind of, don't worry, it's okay. this is not, you're not signing your life away here kind of communication and conversation. But landlords definitely are, you know, interested and motivated to find a way that will help them get the money that they need for their rent. So, so far, so good. It's definitely a conversation point. It's definitely communication challenges and the need to do all that. So there it is, you know, but so far so good. Yeah. And we're making it work and getting this going.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our features were produced by Jim Allison and Diane Walker.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our engineer and executive producer is Kate Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for the Transmission Times, coming up next on WFHB Community Radio.
You've been listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@WFHB.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,